Well, wait till you hear this story. A chemical test used by the Mars Viking landers more than 30 years ago was not sensitive enough to detect signs of alien life, even if they existed, according to a new study. Researchers analyzed soil from several harsh Mars-like environments on Earth using the same gas spectrometry test employed by the Viking landers. But even in soil taken from areas teeming with microbial life, the tests failed to register any signs of organic material. Thus, the Martian surface could have several orders of magnitude more organics than the stated Viking detection limit. The finding, detailed in the current issue of the Journal of Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, could have implications for future missions aiming to dig up signs of extinct or existing life on the red planet. This is a remarkable story. In a moment, another remarkable person, David Darling, joins us on Coast to Coast AM. David Darling, he's a British astronomer, PhD from the University of Manchester, England. He's the author of more than 40 books on subjects ranging from the life in the universe to life after death, from cosmology to consciousness. His latest book is Teleportation, The Impossible Leap. His website, The Worlds of David Darling, tackles everything from silicon-based life to UFOs. DavidDarling.info, also his website. He's our guest on Coast to Coast. Hey, David, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, George. Great to be back on your show.
Welcome back to, the story I just had about the Mars Viking landers, and they didn't have the right equipment sensitive enough. That's incredible, isn't it?
I know, and I've known about that for some time, actually. It's just surfaced again, but it really is amazing. All the experiments on that probe gave a positive signal for life, and the call was given to this instrument called the GCMS, which has turned out to be hopelessly insensitive to organics. So those positive signals are looking very, very interesting.
I was going to say, what does your gut tell you on this now, David, possibly there is some microbial life there on Mars, maybe more?
Yeah, my gut tells me that the Viking did find life. And if you've got simple life, you've got the possibility that it's evolved into more complex life. Sure, it's big news.
And had the planet not died off the way it did, who knows what might have been on that planet?
Exactly, or what might still be there.
See, now you open up all kinds of possibilities, David.
I know, and I'm working on a new book which is going to argue that we've already got very, very strong evidence for life close at hand, not just on one world, but on several in the solar system.
What's your definition of life, that kind of life?
Well, I'm really just talking about life as we know it, not extending much into speculation, just life based on carbon and organics and water and just the sort of thing that we know about. We know that there are creatures on Earth that could survive on Mars, so you don't really have to get too wild in your speculation. Of course, life could be have a different basis, but I think there could be life as we know it elsewhere in the solar system.
You wouldn't be surprised, though, would you, if we had landers that popped into the right spot and, let's say, witnessed or filmed or videotaped, rather, and sent back to us pictures that we would videotape back here, pictures of vegetation. You wouldn't be shocked with that, would you?
I wouldn't be shocked. I'd be quite surprised if it was on the surface in most cases. I'm expecting to find a lot of life beneath the surface. I don't know about vegetation. I've seen pictures, and I'm open-minded, I'm open to be persuaded on that. But you've got to be careful, in how you interpret pictures. I wouldn't be shocked, but I'd be mildly surprised at this stage.
Because I think you are, and we've talked about this before, you are a believer in life throughout the universe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I wrote the book Life Everywhere, the Maverick Science of Astrobiology, in which I argue very strongly that life is a kind of an imperative, and it's going to get going whenever it gets the chance to get going. So I expect it to be relatively common. I think the big issue is how often it becomes intelligent life, and I'm still pretty optimistic on that score, too.
Fascinating program to talk with you tonight about life and who the great creator might be on this in this vast universe, David. But let's talk about since the last time we talked. What have you been up to over the last several months?
Well, working on a couple of projects to do with extraterrestrial life. One is this new book I just mentioned, which we're just getting off the ground. Another is a science documentary, again, on alien life that's being put together here in the UK. It's a 90-minute special that I'm working as a consultant on. And hopefully that'll make its way across the pond and maybe it'll be shown on PBS or something like that. So those are the two big projects I'm involved with presently, both to do with extraterrestrial life.
Good for you. Do you continue to try to get answers as to what is the universe? How is the universe formed? I mean, are you evolving as well?
That's what drives me on, you know, ever since I was a kid. And I think that's the thing. I've not stopped being a kid in terms of the questions that I ask. I still want to know what's the purpose of it, where did it come from, the big issues. And sometimes when you're a research scientist, you're focused on such a tiny little area that you lose sight of the big picture. And I like to retain that. That's why I write about it. I try to explain it to other people rather than research into one very focused little spot of science. So it's the big issues, the question of design and evolution, the question of our ultimate origins, where we're going, life and death, all those sort of things, I think, can be answered. I think they're difficult questions, but they are open to solution in the end if we keep working at them.
Are you a believer in parallel universes?
Well, I think there's a lot of mileage to be gained in that theory that our universe is not the only one, that there is a multiverse, and that there are a zillion universes out there, trillions and trillions of universes, each one a little bit different, some maybe very different from our own, that have evolved in different ways. So if you want to call those parallel universes, they're coexisting universes, yes, I think there's a lot to be said for that theory.
The universe that we exist in now, still with its complexity, that it's expanding, contracting, expanding. In terms of life in the universe, it appears to me that with just looking at Earth, how vast life is on this planet. I mean, there are millions of different kinds of plant life and animal life and insect life. I mean, each one unique by itself.
Yeah.
It would be a marvelous find if you could find just one of the millions of species of plants and animals and insects, humans, that we have on this planet. If you just found one cockroach crawling around on Mars, that would be a major story. Yet look at the life we have on this planet. Mm-hmm. It's got to be all over the place.
Yeah. And we're finding more and more of it in the most unexpected places. Even last week, for example, there was the announcement of the discovery of microbes living 2 miles down or a mile and a half down in a gold mine in South Africa, actually living inside rock, totally independent of light. It was, you know, it runs off energy from radioactive uranium that breaks down water. And this sounds like it's from Star Trek, you know. But everywhere we look, we are finding new types of life. It's just extraordinary, the diversity of it. And the more we look, the more we find. And the more we imagine the sort of places it might be, the more we are finding. We could find eventually there's life in all sorts of apparently impossible places, even here on Earth.
The microbes that are down that far, do they necessarily need to eat? Do they function that way?
They still need to eat in the sense that they have to have nutrients. It's just the question of how they derive their energy. Most of the life on Earth, all of the life on Earth that we've known so far, ultimately depends on light from the sun. Plants, obviously, directly through photosynthesis, and then other animals eat plants, and we eat plants and animals, so we're all dependent on the light from the sun. But these bugs that are, say, deep down in the ground are apparently totally independent of the surface. They are using energy that comes from radioactivity inside the Earth. So, yes, they still have metabolism. They still need energy. They still need to feed and do the things we do, but they do it in a totally different way.
What a remarkable discovery it would be if we could find this on other planets.
I think so, and I think it's happening. It's going to happen. In the next 10 to 15 years, I think it will happen, and it's just going to open up the whole subject of astrobiology. All sorts of interest and money is going to be poured into it, and then we're going to find more and more examples of it. We just need to find that first one example on Mars or Titan or wherever, and the field will be wide open.
The Mars rovers were not equipped to look for this kind of life. So on our next evolution of probes that, let's say, search for life, based on this new study, are they going to change the equipment and the testing procedures?
Well, inevitably they're going to take that into account. There's not actually going to be any direct looking for life for quite a while yet, oddly enough. I would have thought that within the next year or two, we'd be desperate to send probes up there looking for life. But we seem to be more interested in the rocks and searching for water and more cautious approach. I would like to see a repeat of Viking with all of the updated equipment and experiments that we could bring to bear on it to settle it once and for all, because Viking looks hugely important. And I just think the results have been ignored and sort of rubber stamped with no life for some reason or other. I don't know. It seems bizarre because those scientists were so keen to search for life, and we found these positive signals, and yet it's just been assumed that it didn't find anything, when in fact it seems like it did.
When you look at the vastness of the universe, and everything seems to fit like a puzzle,
doesn't it?
I don't understand, David, how it could be that way. I mean, everything has a purpose. Everything is there. It's in place. It's in order. There doesn't seem to be any mistakes.
It gives the appearance of design, doesn't it? You look around the universe and you see structure, you see organization, you see amazing complexity. One of the pictures that that Alex has put up on your website is to go with this talk is of a spiral galaxy. And if you look at that for a few minutes, just gaze at it, you have to wonder at it. Did this thing come about naturally? Was it planned? It just seems that the cosmos was put together according to some master plan. And one scientist, I think it was Freeman Dyson, he works at the Institute for Advanced Physics in Princeton, where Einstein used to work. He said, it's almost as if the universe knew we were coming, as if everything's been one big preparation for us. And another astronomer, one of my favorites, Fred Hoyle, alas, he passed away a few years ago, but he said that the universe seems to him like a put-up job. But the appearance of design isn't necessarily the same thing as design. I think we just have to be a little careful on that. We have to look at other possibilities as well. We just talked about the multiverse, the fact that there could be many, many, many universes out there. And, of course, some of them might not have life in them. Others will have lots of life, but it may be very different from what we know. It's obviously only those universes that have intelligent life that can wonder why they seem to be so special. It's like winning the lottery. The person who wins the lottery thinks, gee, I must be special. How did I win it out of all these millions of people? But, of course, somebody has to win it. So every week you get this person who thinks they're special in some way. And our universe could be a little bit like that. It could be one of trillions, and we just happen to be here. And so we wonder how it all came about, why it seems so perfectly set up for life.
Yet with that same argument, even beyond the universe and what is it and how did it get here, it's us asking us the same question. What are we doing here? What's our purpose? Why are we here every day?
Exactly. And you have to ask that question. It is so vital that you do. There are some scientists who think that the universe is purposeless, that it really just happened and it doesn't have a purpose. And we're just creatures that need to find a purpose in things because it gives us a meaning in our lives. I just cannot go along with that point of view. For me, it's so hard to believe that the universe doesn't have a purpose, because it makes our existence seem pointless. It makes everything we do utterly without consequence, and I can't and won't accept that. I think there are all sorts of ways in which the universe could have a purpose, and I am personally convinced in my gut that it does, that there is a meaning to it.
If there was a meaning, then I assume you believe that the universe then was designed.
Well, That word is loaded, isn't it?
Design. Yeah, it is, and I don't want to put words in your mouth there, Dr. Darling.
Are we talking intelligent design with a capital I and a capital
by the
G?
By the way, that is your last name. I'm not calling you a darling. That is your last name to people you're listening.
You're welcome to do either. That's fine. It's a name you don't forget easily anyway. It depends what you mean by design. Do we mean intelligent design, which of course gets us into the whole business of creationism? Let me quote you some figures. They're very interesting figures that I came up with the other day. It's a poll that was carried out by CBS in October of last year, questioning Americans on their beliefs. And it came up with a finding that 51% of Americans believe that God created humans in their present form. And that response doesn't change much if you say within the past 10,000 years. In other words, just over half of Americans believe in a more or less literal interpretation of the Bible in terms of design. Further, 30% believe that humans evolved, but that God was involved in the process and guided the process. So you've got a massive 81% there who believe that God was instrumental in bringing us about in some way. And only 15%, that's less than one in six, believe that humans evolved and that God wasn't involved. In other words, less than one in six Americans today accept the position of mainstream science on one of the most fundamental questions we can ask, which is where we came from. And I think that is absolutely staggering, that so many, such a huge majority, disagree with the mainstream position of science on that huge, huge issue. It's incredible.
And why do they disagree?
It's not a uniquely American phenomenon, but it's a very strongly American phenomenon. And I think it has to do something to do with the history of belief and Bible belief. And so many people look to the Bible for their guide, not just in spiritual matters, but for historical fact. They treat the Bible, Genesis, we're talking about here in particular, almost as a science textbook. Now, what you asked me, do I believe in design? Now, what I'm referring to here really is intelligent design, which means the involvement of basically a biblical God in bringing humans about. Now, I have to say that I believe in evolution. Okay, I believe humans.
Well, that doesn't take away from your other belief system, I don't think.
It doesn't. But what it does matter is that I'm not talking about intelligent design in terms of a God who is actively involved on a day-to-day basis with tinkering with things, with manipulating things. I can accept design in terms of God as an overall creator and starter off of the universe, and perhaps some master plan on a cosmic level behind the whole thing. I cannot accept the intelligent design argument of a God who's daily involved in manipulating nature. So there is a big difference between those two views.
A God who would cast a flood down on people who might be evil. Don't believe in.
That I find difficult to accept because I don't interpret the Bible literally, word for word. I think Genesis, for example, we can get into this later, and of course it's raising a huge controversy, and maybe half your audience has already turned off, I don't know, but we've got to bring these things out. They're important issues. I don't treat Genesis as a science textbook. I think it's based on a cosmology that is several thousand years out of date. And really, a lot of what is in Genesis is just cosmology that has been picked up from other sources in Mesopotamia at the time it was written. So all of that, I think, stems from this sort of historical belief in the accuracy of the Bible, literally. Now, I don't accept that. Personally, I don't mind other people if they want to believe in that. That's fine. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion. It's not my opinion, is what I'm saying. But I do accept that there may be design behind the whole thing, the whole ball of wax.
What about the potential that the universe as a whole is alive, that everything in it is alive, the substance in the universe is alive? Is that possible, David?
Well, I think it's a fascinating possibility because this gets us into consciousness as well as life. And I believe that consciousness is a fundamental property of the universe. It's not something recent. It's not just something associated with us and a few higher animals. I believe it is a universal quality that possibly the universe as a whole possesses.
All right, stay with us with our special guest tonight, David Darling. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, David Darling, will be back with the astronomer in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, David Darling, our guest. David, the work that you're doing in science, teleportation, searching for extraterrestrial life, are there others like you, solid scientists with just great credentials, who are trying to get these same answers?
Well, it's difficult for professional scientists, people who work in labs and universities. They're working on very specific problems, most of them. The life of a scientist is quite routine and boring. They do quite, it's not a glamorous job. They're not normally looking at the big picture. The people who do are like the cosmologists who are looking at the ends of the universe and the origins of the universe. They do tend to get more into the philosophy of it. The people like me who tend to look at the big picture are the science writers. The people who can afford to look at everything and to take into account all the big picture, and who don't actually have a professional reputation, if you like, to maintain. It's very difficult for professional scientists to step out of line, because if they do, they earn the scorn of their colleagues. So it's difficult for them to be too speculative. That's the problem. Science really has a problem with speculation, with going beyond the accepted norms.
You know, David, I'm sorry, did I interrupt you?
No, please carry on.
The quest, though, for all of us, of course, is to find out exactly why we're here and what our role is in the cosmos. Right before the break, we were talking about my thoughts that maybe this universe is alive. I believe, for example, that planet Earth is alive, yeah, much like a plant might be alive. It's got that kind of feeling to me. It repairs itself. It tries to fix itself. It fights back if it needs to defend itself. And I believe that's what this planet does. I think the universe is in the same category.
Certainly, in terms of the Earth does behave as if it was an organism. You're right. It's in a battle for survival at the moment. The question is, and we're part of the system. Sometimes people think of human beings as being a sort of an aggressor, something that's trying to destroy the planet. But we're part of the whole ecosystem. And I'm an optimist in that I think we are going to eventually find a solution, and we're going to wake up, basically. I think the Earth is a sort of self-correcting system. I think it will recover, although we're going to cause terrible damage to it. I think it will actually recover. And yes, I think you can extend that beyond the Earth to the solar system, for example. You can look at the sun as the nurturer and all of the planets around it as being possible incubators for life. So you then take it to the solar system, then you can take it to the level of the galaxy. And again, if you look at that picture of a spiral galaxy, it looks like it's a perfectly self-contained system. And then, as you say,
it really does. It is magnificent.
You go to the universe as a whole. I do believe you're absolutely right, that there's every evidence that the universe is evolving. It's evolving in as an organism would do. The only thing that you don't have there is, or you may possibly do if you go to the multiverse, but you've only got this one universe we're talking about, whereas on Earth, for example, you've got lots of life forms that are competing and interacting. In the case of the universe, we only know of the one universe at the moment, although, of course, all of these multiverses may be interacting and evolving as well.
I don't want to digress too much, but I have to ask you this as a question of science. Why is it that this species called the human on this planet is constantly fighting and killing itself? I mean, since its inception, I've heard nothing but wars and human beings killing human beings. I mean, what is it about this planet? What is it about, you know, our species that we do this to ourselves?
It's a tough one to ask, to answer that, George. All animals will fight for their survival. We're the number one. We've emerged from 4 billion years of live and let die evolution. We're the top dog. The Earth is also running out of resources, so we're fighting over territory and what's left of the resources of the planet. And basically, we are survival machines, and we will do whatever it takes for us to survive as individuals, as families, as tribes, as nations. We look after number one first. We're having to come to terms with the fact that that's not working anymore on a planetary level. Looking after number one means that you end up destroying the rest of the planet, so you're pulling the rug from underneath yourself. So we're having to come to grips with that. But it's just the way that we've evolved, and I think that is a powerful argument for evolution working alongside design. The fact that our very nature makes us so competitive is because we are survival machines, and we're going to find that throughout the universe.
And it's working. It's working hand in hand, isn't it? Yeah. Evolution with design.
I think you can argue the case that the design may be behind the whole thing, and evolution is what's happening on a day-to-day basis. Yeah.
You know, you bring up some interesting things too in terms of thought that, you know, we can create, for example, virtual realities by the use of a computer.
Mm-hmm.
And you've given us some thought that the entire universe may very well be a virtual reality inside something else.
I think it's a disturbing thought for me. It's a very disturbing thought. But when you think about the way technology is going at the moment, it's not going to be too long before we've got total immersion virtual reality, very much like Star Trek's holodeck. A better word for it perhaps would be simulated reality rather than virtual reality. But it's going to happen. It's going to happen pretty soon. As soon as technology allows, there's going to be a big commercial demand for it. Look at the market for computer games today. It's what's actually driving computer technology forward. Imagine the attraction of being able to disappear into any fantasy world you like. It's going to change us. Maybe end up spending most of our time in this sort of virtual reality. And that'll be a problem for some people. It'll be very addictive.
Go ahead.
No, go and say what you're saying.
I was going to say, let's get your take then on how you think this universe came about.
Well, just to stick with this possibility of virtual reality, if we can simulate, as we will be able to do, other worlds with powerful computers, then maybe we can create simulated brains, thoughts, and people. And then those simulations might create other simulated realities. Now, that is not too big a stretch then to imagine that some other race, far more advanced than us, has already done this and has created a virtual cosmos, and we're characters in it. And it might even be a virtual universe inside a virtual universe, and so on. It's a distinct possibility given the way our technology is going. I think it's a very disturbing one. For one thing, it'd be very hard to prove either way, but it seems like it's a possibility.
Will it end one day, David? Do we have to worry about it in our lifetime?
Well, if it's a virtual reality, of course, somebody could just throw the switch. But
then we're in deep trouble.
Well, what can we do about it? Yeah, what can we do about it? But the way when we look out at the universe, it's really quite surprising. Of course, we know the universe is expanding. We've known that for a long time. But the big surprise in recent years is that we found that the rate of expansion is actually increasing. So it's growing faster and faster because of this new element called dark energy, which works a bit like anti-gravity, pulling the universe apart. So that gives us a rather bleak prospect of the universe growing and growing and everything in it getting further and further apart until even the galaxies break apart and they're just tiny, lonely islands of matter in a vast, dark universe. It'll be a long time before that happens, and perhaps there are ways around it, but that's the forecast at the moment.
If you had an opportunity to ask the creator one question, just one, and he had to move you on your way, what would that question be?
In a way, you sort of, by phrasing the question that way, I suppose my first question if I could have any answered, would be, is there a creator? But given you, the way you phrased it, I suppose it would be, why am I here? Why am I here? You see, if there was a creator, I wouldn't worry too much about the afterlife, because I would think that was probably factored in somehow. But I would want to know what was my personal reason for existing. That is something that bothers me a great deal, is why am I here?
You and I are very similar, David, when it comes to questions like that, affecting both of us, I think, at a very young age, pushing us in similar but different directions, because it almost, for me, is an obsession with trying to figure this question out. And the older I get now, you know, I'm 56 years old, I'm not 20, I'm not 30. And I never thought, you know, you at 20, when you think of 56, you went, my gosh, that's 36 years away from now. Who's going to worry about that?
When you're 20, you're immortal.
It was like yesterday now.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. This is the age where you start to think, well, how many years have I got left? 30, 40 if I'm lucky. And you think, right, well, now I really want to know what's going to come next.
You do. You become obsessed with that. And I think one of my missions on this program now has been to try to get these answers from so many informed people like yourself, maybe just for myself. You know, I hope to share it with everybody who listens.
Yep. Yep.
And it's become a huge audience. And I think that could be one of the reasons. I think a lot of people are on the same bandwagon. Yep. They too want these answers.
Yeah. And I think it's a very valid that. I think there's perhaps no more important question you can ask during life than what happens when you die. I know it sounds morbid, but it's not. It's only morbid if you think death is the end and it equates to decay and sadness and all that sort of thing. It's not. I think it's the most important question you can keep in mind. And it also provides a framework for your life. Most of us go through our everyday lives just as a sort of routine, and it's pretty pointless, really. We're just doing a job to put food on the table at the end of the day so we can survive another day, and it can end up being a treadmill. But beyond that, we've got the vastness of the universe and also the vastness within us as well. If you care to contemplate and meditate, you find that there's a huge, almost infinite universe inside your mind as well as a universe out there. So it's important to keep asking these questions, because that gets us to the essence of being, rather than these very humdrum things that we spend most of our time doing.
You're in the United Kingdom. I'm live today in St. Louis. Most of the time when you and I talk, I'm in Los Angeles.
Sure.
And here in St. Louis, they are hosting the World Series, our great baseball annual event, with the Detroit Tigers, which is my born hometown. I was born in Detroit. So, you know, I'm saying to myself, I can't lose. Either St. Louis or Detroit will win the World Series. I win, no matter what. So I've got to take that approach mentally. But we're in St. Louis, and there's so many things that happen within a city, within a community. Yet there are people that I talk to on a regular basis who they too are obsessed with this question about what happens. And a year or so ago, there was a baseball pitcher for the St. Louis Cardinals, and he was having dinner with his brother. And he was going to pitch a game soon. And he said, you know, I just don't feel good. I'm going to go to bed. He goes to bed, and this is a guy in his 20s. He never wakes up. He just doesn't wake up. He dies right there. And again, that's part of that question of that obsessed question of what's out there on the other side.
I think so. And of course, we can get clues from people who almost die from the near-death experiences.
Yes, I think so. We get glimpses of what might be over there.
I always think of these people that, and there are many of them. It's surprising when you get talking to people. Most people are embarrassed or just want to keep it private. So, and that's very valuable testimony when you come across a person who is reluctant to tell you, but then it comes out, because then you know they're not making it up. I think of these people as because I'm a space guy. I think of them as being like sample return probes. We send these spacecraft out to dip into a comet or or surface of an alien world that we can't really go there in person yet, and we bring back a little sample of what it was like. And I think these people are like that. They cross this boundary, or they enter this transition zone between life and death, and they bring us back a little bit of precious information. They tell us what it's like to approach that boundary between life and death, and we have to use that as scientific data. And the elements, of course, we see some quite common elements: the white light at the end of a tunnel, the vision of loved ones who've passed away, and all of this is valuable data on what it might be like to die.
And I think it's all tied into what is out there in the universe. This interconnection. Of what I've always called the wireless internet, David, it's connected. And if I'm correct, if you're correct, that something exists beyond life in the afterlife, and that it's part of the universe, it's normal, whatever it could be, it's always there. It's supposed to be there. It's not
exactly.
Supernatural. It's not paranormal. It's normal. It's
exactly.
There.
Absolutely. And I think that we call this life and we call what happens next death, but I think death is actually just a transition between life and a greater life. I think what we see now is very limited. Our vision is very limited. We can only see in a tiny portion of the spectrum. We can only hear certain frequencies. We have a very, very limited experience compared to what is actually out there. And for me, one of the most telling features of the near-death experience is this huge expansion of consciousness that people report, the feeling of suddenly being everything, that there's a loss of the sense of self, but all of a sudden they say everything was there, the whole universe was there. And that shouldn't happen if the brain is closing down, according to the conventional view of science, because if the brain gives rise to consciousness, why should you get this huge expansion of it just as the brain is about to close down? That's why we've got it wrong. Consciousness is out there. It's not inside the brain. The brain, if anything, is a limiter of consciousness. It's only when it's out of the way that we fully appreciate what is there. And that's
I agree, yeah.
Yeah, that's the conscious universe. We become one with, if you like, the universal mind, rather than being just a limited, rather paltry little biped on some forgotten planet. We suddenly become linked with the whole universe.
You know, this picture again that you sent to Webmaster Lax, which he's got posted now, the spiral. I mean, the more you look at it, the more you have to tell yourself that was created. It's like a picture. It's like an artist painting it on a piece of canvas.
You've got, I believe, the two factors of some sort of a master plan there, and some sort of evolutionary processes are taking place, because we can look back in time in the universe and we can see more and more primitive forms of galaxies. We know that they have evolved just as life has evolved. So there is an evolution taking place. But at the same time, you can't get away from the fact that this looks like it's according to some blueprint. That there is some design in there. It's the balance between the two, I think, that's important. So evolution and design working together.
I saw a Hubble picture of another nebula out there. And I got to tell you, to me, David, it looked like some of the pods that ultimately bred other planets or who knows what.
Oh, yeah.
It looks like eggs. Almost like, a chicken would hatch an egg.
Yeah.
It looks like the universe is creating eggs.
Yeah, those analogies are, there may be more than analogies, I agree. Sometimes you see these sort of reflections of the familiar on the large scale, and you think, yeah, I can see a connection there. See a connection. The universe is all connected. It's all in, there's nothing that is apart. We're not apart from the universe. We're made of stuff that was once inside stars. Literally made of stardust. All the atoms in our body were forged in the interior of stars. So we've got this deep connection. When you look up at the stars, you're seeing your birthplace out there. And it's important to have that cosmic connection, that link. Get away from your everyday little life. Realize that you are actually the universe. You're a portion of the universe.
Connect. It changes. Changes your perception, David,
yeah.
Of everything when you begin to think that way.
Yeah, you reconnect with the universe, and that's so important. Answers everything.
Hey, David, next hour let's talk about the search for life within our solar system, within our universe. and see if we can find some intelligent life like ours. What is your website, David, the one that you recommend?
Okay, David Darling, all one word, .info, I-N-F-O.
All right, we'll be back with Dr. David Darling in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.